Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel, live broadcast and podcast. Today, we are covering five things you can learn from an ultra DNF with the bodacious podium placing coach and physio, Tim Piggott from HP3 Coaching. How are you today, Tim?
Oh, I'm good. Your introductions get more embarrassing every time.
Yeah, that is my aim. Thank you.
Apologies for those who are watching this live or listening live. That's my fault. We're running a bit behind. trying to squeeze my run in this morning and, didn't quite get back in time.
Yeah, well, it's a very noble cause for being late. We'll let you off for having a shower there, even though this is not smell-o-vision. But you came second. All this training's paying off. You came second in the Hardmore Saltburn Marathon, 28 miles, the other weekend. How was that?
Yeah, that's it. It's the Hardmores. You kind of get some free bonus miles you don't have to pay for. that was a good day. I think we had sort of unseasonably good conditions. It's the first Hardmores race that I've done, but if you're listening to this, the chances are you've heard of the Hardmores events. John and Shirley put on some brilliant events, and they've got a really good following there. And I think sort of traditionally Saltburn is either very thick mud or just storms or snow or gale force winds or whatever. So we had quite a calm day. So I think our conditions were unseasonably kind.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was good. Yeah. I actually went into the race just a little bit sick, just sort of head cold. So I wasn't feeling superb. It turned out I got a second place. So happy with that. Yep.
Yeah. And were you second overall then? There wasn't women around like Jasmine Paris waiting to
second overall. Yeah.
Yeah. And did you see the first placed guy?
No, he was about 10, 15 minutes ahead of me. It was one of those where I set off and wasn't feeling brilliant, and there were sort of three other guys ahead of me, and I just realised I wasn't going to dig a hole and try and push on. I've got Chianti coming up, the 100K, in about sort of 5 weeks' time now, so I didn't want to dig a hole and sort of settle into what turned out to be fourth place, and then the guy who'd taken the lead at the early stages, he unfortunately pulled his calf, so he pulled out at about mile 8. So I found myself comfortably in third place with a big gap behind, and was just happy to stay there really and just run a nice tempo run. But then got to about 18 miles and got sight of the chap in second place and just slowly reeled him in and caught him at mile 25. And yeah, I mean, he gave me a pat on the back and just said, he was sort of blown.
And then tripped you up.
but he still finished pretty strong. So, you know, I worked hard for those last couple of miles once I got into second. But it was a good day out. Good training day.
And sometimes it's harder to be chased, isn't it, than to chase? Like when you were chasing him down, you've got an objective, you've got someone to look at, and then you're like, oh, keep him behind me. Oh, no.
it's horrible being chased down. So,
Oh, well, congratulations. That's really good. And so Chianti's next month. Is it early on next month or is it in the middle?
No, it's got to sort of towards the end of the month.
Towards the end of the month.
I've got about sort of 4 weeks of hard training and then taper down into it. So it's the sort of 22nd of March. That's sort of Friday, Saturday job.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Oh, well, we're looking forward to hearing all about that one. But today we're going to be talking about the opposite, which is five things to learn from a DNF. So yeah. Just before we start, I've got to do a quick shout out to the sponsor of the episode, NAC Sports Nutrition. They make the energy bars, the waffles, energy and recovery powders, and real food purees in pouches. So I used their bars and waffles on the Arc of Attrition. They tasted blooming delicious. I highly recommend them. So use code WILDGINGERRUNNING, all caps, for 15% off at uk.nac.com. And let me know how you get on with them as well. Let me know if you like them like I do. So right, DNFs, like they totally suck, don't they? How can we rise above that pain and learn from them? Coach Tim?
So the simple fact is, if you do this game for long enough, you're going to DNF at some stage. Anybody that hasn't DNF'd is just a question of time. It's not if, it's when. It will happen.
Or maybe you're not pushing yourself. You know, like, I knew that rope cutoffs on the arc would be harsh. And, like, for me, that's pushing myself. So, you know, I could have always chosen ones with really generous cutoffs and always completed them.
Yeah, or you're going to go for shorter events and things where it's, you know, very much within your comfort zone. But,
or
you know, we do
injured.
These. Yeah, but we do these things to challenge ourselves and push ourselves. And if you're not, you know, pushing to those limit occasionally, then, you know, it depends what you're looking for in terms of the sport, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're watching this YouTube, whichever way around, the chances are, you know, you're picking some more challenging events and targets, and occasionally you're going to come across a situation where you can't finish. And of course, it's a horrible thing, but I think it's useful to then also flip that to you did nothing fatal.
Yes, that's a good
because
point.
Sometimes, you know, trying to push on is not a sensible thing to do, and not finishing can be very much the very sensible and very safe thing to do, no matter how much it hurts. And of course, we learn more from our mistakes than we do from our successes.
Yeah, definitely.
So the important thing is, you know, when it does happen, is take that time to reflect on why did it happen and what can you learn from that, so that hopefully that particular situation doesn't happen again. You know, of course, it all depends on why it happened, and there's lots of reasons why you might not finish a race. And I think, you know, we can maybe explore some of those. Yes, okay, fine. We can maybe use your recent example at the Arc as a sort of anchor point for this conversation, but I think it's useful to maybe think about other reasons why people DNF, so that they can reflect on maybe their own past experiences and also try and then learn from other people's mistakes and why other people have DNF'd, and hopefully they're not make that same mistake themselves. So
should
we have a think about that?
My race film is called How Not to Run the Arc of Attrition 50, so hopefully people will be able to pick up some tips from there. But I have written, there's kind of eight things that I've written that I could do differently if I do it next year. And if all of those things worked, then hopefully I'd be a lot more ahead of the cutoffs. Each little incremental thing would help a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can talk through those points that you've written out.
Yeah, so I've divided them into sort of topics, so to sort of make them a bit more general for people, so it's not just like me and this is how my race went.
So you've written down the sort of first thing was the taper, and did you get the taper right? And we sort of touched on this a little bit on the last call that we did, in the last podcast. And there's always that tendency to try and squeeze in a bit extra.
Yeah.
And of course, it's far better to be stood on that start line undertrained, but rested and fresh, than to have nailed those last few training sessions. But then you end up on the start line just a little bit tired, maybe a little bit niggly, and not as fresh as you could be.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. It's a question of did you try and squeeze too much into the week before?
Yeah, I think I did. I did a few little short runs, and like more than I would have in just a normal training week, in the way the training was going this time. And then I also recce'd the course the previous day. So I did 6.5 miles because I really wanted to look at Sally's Bottom, the infamous steps just before the end. It's like 2 miles from the end. And I wanted to sort of know where to go, because I thought, if I am going to get through the checkpoints and be like really at that end cutoff of 15.5 hours, I don't want to be messing around trying to know which way to go. But so mentally, that was a really good plan, because I had that in my head and I would have known where to go even in the dark. But physically, that was definitely not a good plan, because you know, I don't know if you've ever stood on the start line of a race and your legs have just felt leaden, like they should feel pingy, shouldn't they? They should feel like ping, 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 ready to go. Yeah, honestly, I felt just like I was already in the middle of the race when I started, so that was not a good move.
I mean, in terms of what you should do the day before, some people perform well on just having complete rest the day before. Most people will race better having done a little bit the day before. So I get most of my athletes to do even just 20 minutes, just a little shake out and a few strides, and that might be enough. But, you know, doing 10K, 6 miles or something like that beforehand is probably a little bit too much.
And especially those steps, like I was unaccustomed to that kind of thing anyway. So that was not a great plan.
So then, okay, so then you think about, you know, why did you do that? And it was for the mental preparation, the visualization.
Navigation,
But, you know, Google Street View is so good these days, because so many roads and paths and everything. You'll probably find that somebody has hiked along there with a 3D camera.
Okay.
And you've got Google Street View, or, you know, at least photographs of. So there's so much of the race visualization that you can do just sat looking at your computer screen.
Okay.
So I think it's going through that. It's, you know, you've obviously filmed a section of the race, but there's plenty of other people who've done their own films of the race in the past. So it's always worth trawling back through, you know, previous race footage, people's videos, so that you can visualize as much of that race route as possible. You know, I've done numerous races overseas, and it's the very first time being on those trails. But it's that continual kind of turn around a corner. Oh, yeah, I recognize this now. Oh, yeah, I recognize that. Oh, yeah, and we've got this turn coming up. Oh, yeah, there it is. Lovely, great. Because I've seen it on video so many times from other people's YouTube channels or race reports or whatever it is.
Yeah. See, I was trying to watch some other YouTube videos, but I would watch the first bit and then I'd be like, oh, that looks all nice. And then I would run out of time. I'd have to get on to something else. So I never watched the end of anyone's YouTube film. So that is what I need to do next time.
So for races, I'll make up a YouTube playlist of people's videos of races, and I'll watch those while I'm on the treadmill. So I'm running along, essentially visualizing running that race.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Until you were so ingrained in your mind that you can just do it in your sleep.
Yeah, I need to get a treadmill then.
That might help with some of the other aspects of why you didn't finish as well in terms of the training.
Me and Steve, I just did a Zwift on Thursday because it was horrible here, and I did a Zwift. Steve set me up with my bike on his Zwift, and it was really fun actually. But every time I saw someone running on the Zwift, I felt like I wanted to be running instead. So we were talking about getting a treadmill, and then we could actually talk to each other while we both did Zwift. So that would be quite good.
Yeah, I mean, it's no getting away from the fact that the treadmill can get boring, but, you know, I'll connect my treadmill up to Zwift, but quite often I'm watching something else on video at the same time, you know, Netflix or Prime or other video services are available. So I think it's just a question of making sure that you don't try and squeeze too much in, and having the confidence that it's okay to be maybe undertrained but rested on the start line versus having squeezed in that final extra session. And having the confidence to look back on your previous training and your previous experience there.
Yeah, maybe I could have just recce'd like the final road junction and then not gone up all the hill that was waymarked, because it was all like waymarked with little flags. I could have just gone to that junction and gone, so you come down off the coast path, you go along this road, you turn left, you turn right. Oh, there's a big hill now. I'll not do that. Yeah,
exactly.
We've got a live comment from Cotswold Trail Runner, whose film I was just watching just before this broadcast. He's had a really successful, he did it at the 100-mile race. Congratulations.
Very good.
And his film has been watched by over 10,000 people. So it's done really, really well. He said for the arc, he couldn't recce any of the routes, so he used YouTube videos and the course breakdown. It's very detailed, so he could replicate that elevation and distance in training.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, you want to look at the race profile. So, you know, as you mentioned, I've got Chianti coming up. You know, I've looked at every single climb and descent and worked out the length of every climb, the gradient of every climb, and worked out, you know, Strava segments in my local area, which will replicate those climbs.
Yeah.
And you just then build that into your training.
Such a good way of doing it. Yeah, it is really, really good.
So do your homework.
I did, yeah, literally no homework. So we'll get on to my lack of training in a minute. But the next one was gear. So gear, I felt like I took the right stuff. We'll come on to some different parts of gear, like nutrition and GoPro and stuff in a minute. But poles was an interesting one on the arc because they were useful for me. I found them useful, but most people didn't have them. And I feel like it's something, if you had a crew, you probably would have gone, oh, I'll use the poles for this section, but not that section, and something like that. So you maybe wouldn't have had to carry poles the whole time. But yeah, that's really personal, isn't it? Using things like poles on ultras and how that contributes to whether you DNF or not.
So I think with poles, if you're very well practiced, you know, your technique is very good, and it is very much that forward drive Nordic walking or running technique, then they can be, you know, they can improve your efficiency, they can reduce the strain on both the ups and the downs, so they can be useful. But of course, if you're not conditioned to using poles, then they will burn more energy, and if your coordination and your skill isn't up to scratch, then you may end up actually going slightly slower with poles than you would do otherwise. Now you know, on a personal level, you know, you've got a very big background in terms of hiking and walking and therefore using poles from that perspective. So, you know, one would hope that your technique is pretty good and you're quite purposeful and forward driving with your poles rather than potentially then slowing yourself down. So, you know, it is a very personal thing. You know, for a 50K to 50 mile, you know, it's a bit of a kind of, really depends on the terrain and are the climbs long enough to be worth getting the poles out? Are you efficient with how quick you can get them out and then put them away again? Can you do that on the move? You know, can you be running at the same pace while you get your poles out and then put them away again? Or are you needing to stop or to walk to do that? And of course, every time you have to stop to get your poles out or put them away, or if you have to walk to get your poles out and put them away again, that's just slowing you down. So it's one of those where if you're going to use them, you've got to practice a lot in training and make sure that you are efficient with the both using the poles but also getting them out and put them away again.
Yeah, definitely. Once I got them out, I didn't put them away. I can't be bothered to faff around doing that. So I just sort of hold them in one hand like a javelin if I am not needing them. Quite a few times because it was so rocky, especially that section Pendine to St Ives there, I was holding them in both in one hand and then using my other hand to sort of scramble around the rocks. So I can see why people weren't using poles. And the paths were really narrow in a lot of places. So it was, you know, difficult to like place the poles. But I did find them really useful hopping over the bogs and things like that. So yeah, I don't know whether I would ditch them next time. They're like a bit of a crutch for me. Up all those hills, they did definitely help. Jade did the race. She said she used poles later on in the race. She kept them tucked away in a race belt. And Cotswold Trail Runner says he carried poles as he hadn't recce'd the route. But because of the terrain, he didn't use them till the final 20 miles when he was fatigued and the route was more runnable. So I suppose if you had a crew, then you could get them to give you the poles at a certain place, like maybe at St Ives or something like that. Christian did the race as well. He said, I found the poles really useful for the uphill sections, but on the flat, he probably wasn't that efficient with them.
That's usually the case.
Yeah, so I've got some videos on how to run with poles and like how to select the right length and stuff. So I'll maybe point them up here, or actually I'll link them in the film description below. That's probably the best way. So if you're if you're wanting to know, someone called Dean wants to know the best way to train with poles, that'll be in that video there for you, Dean. So yeah, so that was a bit of gear that was different. So that's like
on the poles front, you know, I've got a range of videos which I'll be releasing as well, so we can maybe link into that. But there are, I don't do them, but there are people who run courses on how to run the poles. Charlie Sponson, good friend of mine, up in the Lake District, another Scarpa athlete. he runs, you know, courses, weekend courses on how to run with poles. So, you know, if you really are very new to this and you are picking a, you know, a mountain race and you're thinking, right, I really do need to get good at running with poles, it might be worth actually, you know, spending a day with a coach and really, you know, accelerating your learning process on how to use them.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think some people can be all fingers and thumbs with them, can't they? Like, and trip over them and trip other people over with them. So, yeah, some people do need to. It's not intuitive for some people. Some people are just like, dum, 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 what's there to learn? Yeah. But, yeah. So that's gear. So we've done tapering, we've done gear. Then I thought maybe we should discuss, like, a third aspect of nutrition and hydration. Because that must be like a massive big thing for why a lot of people DNF. So
it is the biggest reason why people DNF ultramarathons is GI upset, gastrointestinal upset. So essentially they get nutrition wrong. You know, either, you know, try and eat too much and make themselves sick, or don't take on enough and run out of energy. You know, again, hydration issues, whether they're drinking too much, not enough. Getting your, if you are using salts, getting your salts wrong. So yeah, nutrition and hydration are the biggest reason why people end up DNFing races. So it's the biggest reason people list. So the way to overcome that is you've got to test your nutrition. You've got to train your nutrition in training so that you know exactly what's going to work on race day. And you've also got plan B and plan C for in case something starts to go wrong on race day and you know how to act on it. You commented on the fact that you drank a whole bunch of Coke at one of the aid stations and then felt a bit rough after that.
500 mil.
Yeah, so, you know,
And I never have Coke in training. It was kind of flat. It wasn't like really fizzy. It was just in my soft bottle. So I probably had half a soft bottle, like gulped it down. Yeah. Then I had tummy ache for the entire rest of the race. And I think it's probably because there's caffeine in Coke, isn't there? So it makes everything want to digest. So I had to go to the loo for a little while at St. Ives and I still wasn't right, and it was really hurting through the dunes, and I had to slow to a walk. So maybe I shouldn't accept Coke.
So that's it. So, you know, did you have too much sugar in your stomach at that moment in time, and therefore your body was trying to dilute that, shunting fluids into your stomach, and then that bloats or into your intestines, and then that then bloats, and that's where a lot of the issues come from. So if you're drinking a whole bunch of Coke on top of other nutrition, then that can sometimes push you sort of over the edge.
Definitely did for me.
So again, if you're not used to taking Coke in training, then is it the right thing to do in racing? I mean, I'll be honest, I never use Coke in training, but I know that I can cope with it on race day. You know, towards the end of a race when you're just needing that little bit of extra caffeine hit. I mean, as people see, I'm always sat here with my coffee, you know, caffeine.
Whereas I don't ever drink any caffeine at all. Like, so Coke really affects me. Maybe I should train with some flat Coke. Like, maybe I should take, you know, a half a flask of Coke with me and just see what happens. Because it'd be useful. It's always on offer, isn't it? So it would be useful to train myself to be able to accept Coke.
That's it. And you can train your stomach to be able to cope with more carbs and than maybe usual. So it is something you just got to work on in training and test in training. So, you know, find the products that work for you. And then if they're available at the race, fantastic. If they're not, you got to think about, are you going to carry your own nutrition? Or look ahead, think about what the race is going to have on offer at the aid stations. You know, if they've got a particular sponsor, then, you know, you might need to then go and buy some of their nutrition in advance and tested in training, so you know whether it works for you or not.
Yeah, but we've had an interesting question on the live here about that fueling and training for that fueling to avoid DNFs in the future. How do you train, say if you're doing the 100-mile version or a 50-miler and you're only running 30 miles maximum in training, how do you know how you're going to be in that last 20 miles? Is it just sort of like experience of races then after that sort of thing?
So some of it's experience, for sure. And then it's about having, as I mentioned, the sort of plan B and plan C. So we often talk about having like a sort of bullseye. So in the centre of that bullseye, you've got, you know, a couple of products that you know are your kind of go-to race nutrition that will work for you. And then the next ring of that bullseye are the kind of similar products that you know work for you, but they're just not maybe your 100% favourite product, but you're quite happy to use if need be. And then maybe the sort of less... if you're going very much gels and very processed stuff in the center of that bullseye, then maybe the slightly less processed the next ring. And then you've got your outer ring of that bullseye, which is again similar products, but they're not your usual go-to, but they are your backups. So for me, you know, the center of that bullseye would be I go for pretty simple, easily digestible. So I'll have my precision hydration gels, and I'll have my Supernatural for my sort of real food to get a bit of fats and protein in there. But if for some reason my stomach's not wanting those, you know, I know that most other gels will work for me, or might be picking up some, you know, some jelly sweets, Haribo, something like that. It might be picking up some, you know, just bits of fruit or a bit of flapjack you can normally get at an aid station. And again, if they're not working, then it's, you know, what's the next layer out from there? So it's working out your plan B's and your plan C's so that, yes, if you do get to the latter end of a race and your stomach's starting to say, don't really want that, what's the plan? You know, for a 100-mile race, it may well be that you start off with your slightly more complex, slightly more real food. And then, yeah, towards the end of the race, you're needing to think about some taste fatigue. So do you need to switch up your flavours? Do you need to get some stronger flavours in there? Are you going to switch to things which are a lot more simple? So are you going to start off with complex stuff and you're going to end up just smashing the gels at the end just to get yourself through to the finish because you don't really want to eat anything anymore? You know, those strategies work, but it's about testing as much as you can.
Yeah.
You know, in preparation.
And then in the race as well.
Yeah. So if you're training for 100, the chances are in your training block, you're probably going to have a 50 miler in there as maybe as a training race. So it's testing that and what works in those last few, last couple of hours of a 50 miler. That's going to give you a good indication.
So test it in training and testing in racing and then just trying stuff on your race. And how, like you're talking about training the gut to deal with that effort level and digestion at the same time. How do you do that? Is it just a question of just fueling your long runs every time?
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
time, just as you would in a race. That's how you train it, I'm assuming.
So you gradually, what we call titrate, so you gradually increase the number of maybe carbohydrates per hour that you're taking on. So it might be you start off on those long runs and you aim to take on 50 grams of carbs, fine. And maybe drinking 500 mils of fluid an hour. Okay, fine. And then the next time you go out for those long run, you try and take 60 and then 70 and then 80, 90, 100, 110, 120, whatever it might be. You might be able to get up to 120 grams an hour. And you've got to think about also doing this at your race intensity. So it's all very well taking large amounts of carbohydrate on board at a very low intensity in your long run. And then you go and try and race at a much higher intensity or very hot conditions, things like that. And you find actually you can't take on that number of carbohydrates. So what you do is you find the limit where your stomach starts to go, no, I don't want that anymore. And then you bring it back down a level and you find that sweet spot where you can, you know, smash as many carbs as possible, but not cause that upset.
Yeah.
So it's about just being very systematic with that training program. In the same way that you gradually increase your time or your mileage, you gradually increase the number of carbohydrates you're taking on per hour, and you test and test and test.
Yeah, so training in the same way that you would do the physical training.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which brings us on to point number four, which is physical training. So looking back on physical training, is that's a good thing to do if you've DNF'd, would you say?
Absolutely. You know, did you do enough? I think about, you know, my most painful DNF, which was Ultra Trail Monte Rosa, DNF'd at mile 86. And yeah, you know, looking back on it, I underestimated the climbs. You know, I thought I was doing enough in terms of my hills and the mileage. But yeah, I just underestimated the technicality of the terrain in a few places, certainly the altitude, but also just the duration of those climbs. So it was a case of, yeah, I wasn't as prepared as I thought I was. Again, you know, my nutrition strategy was based on a faster time than I was actually able to do, which meant that my resupplies at each aid station were running out. So I was underfueling because it was taking me longer to get between particular aid stations. And then also I hadn't slept for 3 nights before the race, which didn't help either.
Oh, no.
No, that wasn't help. No, that was a sort of catalogue of errors when it came to travel to get out there. But anyway, that's by the by. So yeah, you look back and you reflect and think, right, you know, what training did I do? And did it meet the demands and the requirements of that event?
Yeah, I don't think mine did. I thought a January race would be like, brilliant, that will motivate me to train for the whole of December. But in reality, I didn't realise that I would have this like massive training slump in December. It just seemed to be too hard to do anything proper. And that combined with eating this giant cake that my friend made me. I'm just going to put a picture up on the screen for people watching the YouTube now. It looks like it's bigger than Finley's head, this cake. So it's probably about the size of, like, a bit near to my size of head. And then it's a Christmas pudding. It looks like a Christmas pudding, but it's actually a massive chocolate cake with 5 layers of chocolate ganache inside it and white chocolate on the top and icing berry things on the top and holly. And my friend Katie made me this cake over Christmas, and of course we couldn't eat it in one sitting. So I had probably a piece or two of that cake every day. Then Auntie Helen came round.
Did you not share it out?
Well, Steve couldn't eat. No, Steve could eat it, but it was my cake. So mainly I ate it. And Steve was trying to lose weight, so he wasn't eating the cake. And then Auntie Helen kept coming around with Christmas cakes for Steve because she was testing out gluten-free baking. So she came around with about 3 massive fruit cakes as well, which I was devouring. So I was having like 2 pieces of cake a day for about a month. So I've put on 4 kilograms. I've put on 4 kilograms. I'm now the heaviest I've been, apart from pregnant with Finley. I'm nearly 69 kilograms at the moment. And my usual weight is like 64, 65. Like when I get to 65, I'm like, oh, I'm getting a bit fat. I need to rein in the cake now. But I just didn't weigh myself for ages. And so now I'm carrying an extra 4 kilograms over Christmas. I don't know when it started. It might have started earlier than that. But yeah, it's very distressing. And also I'm in my 40s now, so obviously it takes, you know, you put on weight like that, don't you, in your 40s, and you can't get it off very quickly. So yeah, massive training slump in December combined with eating lots of cake equals very bad fitness and not fit enough for the arc. No way. Like, I just wasn't doing the intense sessions that you'd need to go that fast. And you know, the ones you were telling me to do, which was like, you know, like 2 minutes times five up a big hill sort of thing.
And that's it. I think you need to reflect on, you know, when... You know, when you pick these races, the dates of these races, is that going to fit with life? Yes, I've got this race coming up in March. It is towards the sort of end of March. You know, historically, I've tried to in big races end of Feb or sort of very first beginning of March. And it's always been a real battle over the winter months to get that training in. I usually suffer quite badly with sort of asthma over the winter. Apologies if my sort of, I'm quite conscious. I keep sort of trying to clear my throat at the moment, and little mini coughs. That's the sort of one of the symptoms. So apologies if that is coming through on the podcast. So yeah, you know, I know that trying to do a winter race, you know, people keep asking me, "Oh, why are you not doing the spine race in the winter?" It's like, well, you know, me trying to prepare for a January race, it's asking for trouble. You know, it's asking to be ill just before the race. So yeah, this one in March is probably a bit earlier than I'd really like to do now, but
yeah,
it's just the way the sort of the calendar's worked out. So yeah, so it is about reflecting on that yourself, you know, is, you know, with everything else that you're going on with, you know, young family and everything else, is training through December, you know, how realistic is that? And are you better to pick, you know, summer and autumn races as your kind of key events? And then pick some more, you know, low-key stuff to be keeping yourself focused over the winter months. You know, that might be something to reflect on.
The trouble is, I do want to complete it. And I think the best way to do that would be to do it next year whilst it's still fresh in my mind. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I leave it 5 years, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, it's this again, and do the same mistakes again.
But then, you know, you're not going to be as complacent. You're going to go into this going, right, I need to get this training done, because if I don't, it's going to hurt again and it's going to be expensive. And, you know, I think as this sport has grown exponentially over the last couple of years, you know, we are seeing a lot of people who are signing up to these races and they're just not prepared for them. And they're paying a lot of money. And to not finish, having paid a lot of money for your race entries and travel and accommodation and all the rest of it, you know, it's, you've got to wake up and realise you've got to put some hard work in and get that training in. And you've got to then, I think, have a sort of an honest conversation with yourself regarding, have I got the time to train for this? You know, what is my goal? What do I need to do to achieve that goal? And have I got the resources to do it? And if the answer to that is I don't have the resources, you need to adjust your goal and pick something different. You know, is 50 miles too much? Is 50K a more achievable, you know, it's a challenge, but is that a more achievable distance to be targeting? This is not necessarily pointed to you, but it's just reflecting on, you know, anybody that's looking at these events, is when you sign up for these, you've got to then think about, you know, what's the needs analysis for that race, and have you got the capacity to meet those needs?
Yeah, I don't know, because next year it might be exactly the same. But if I do all these other things that I've listed, maybe that will just give me the edge just to get through Godevery, and then I'll just try and go from there. If I do all the things on my list, then I might not need to be that much lighter or that much fitter, because I might just scrape round. Because I definitely, efficiency is a good one to look at as well. I think is this number five, maybe? Efficiency, number five. I stayed too long at St. Ives. It was only, I stayed there for 25 minutes, which is quite a long time.
So it's probably 20 minutes too long.
Yes.
Or 23 minutes too long.
Yeah, well, I was, 20 minutes after the cutoff at Godevery. So, if I'd have just gone in and out. But I needed the loo as well. And I had to just sit on the loo for a while, and then I checked my phone and one of my friends sent a scan picture, so I had to reply congratulations to that. So, you know, there was a lot of things that I did which was a really stupid idea.
Yeah, not needed in the race.
So she could have waited a few hours for congratulations.
One of my athletes, she's, a lot older, 70s, and, she is fighting the cutoffs for the races that she does. So, we've worked really hard on being super efficient. You know, there is just not a single second wasted once that gun goes. Mm-hmm. Aid stations have to be Formula One pit crew. Just, as you're approaching the aid stations, your water bottles are already out of your pack. The tops are already screwed off. And you come into that aid station, quickly fill them up, re-screw the bottle tops, and you walk out of there and you start then reloading your pack whilst you're walking out. If you're picking up food, you grab the food, you walk out of the aid station, then you start eating it as you're walking up the trail. Because then you can get 5-10 minutes up the trail and then start running rather than being sat down at the aid station. As soon as you sit down, you're going to start seizing up.
Yeah.
So, don't sit down. Just keep pushing. It's that relentless forward progress.
Yeah. I mean, you'll see in my film, I get into the aid station. I'm like, what do I need? I think I'll have a cup of tea. Gave someone my mug, gave someone my water bottles, looked at the food, thought, oh, I've got loads of food in my bag. I probably should eat that. Got all the food out. And I had a lot of food going on and it was all in the wrong places. So I couldn't really get to it. And I do feel like on a race like the Arc, if you have a crew, that could really, really help in terms of you're not carrying as much food and potentially not as much water as well. Because I only used 500 ml of water until I got to Senen, which is about an hour and a half into the race. So, because I'd necked a big cup of tea at the Linac.
When you're looking at the kit, they'll often say you need to have the capacity to carry 500 ml, 1 litre, 2 litre, 3 litre, whatever it might be. But that's, you need the capacity to carry.
Yeah.
And you think about, the spine race, take that as an example, you need to have the capacity to carry 3 litres of water. But there's so much water out on the course, you only ever need to have 500 mils full at any one time. You just keep refilling it. You don't need to carry 3 kilograms of kit. You just carry 500 grams, your 500 mil bowl. It's, thinking about, the race I did the other weekend there. You had to be able to carry 1 litre. I only ever had 500 mils filled at any one time as I was leaving an aid station. Then I'd drink that, then refill at the next one. The other bottle was essentially empty. I started with one bottle full, drank that, got to the next aid station. I had my energy powder in that bottle ready, but empty. So then just filled with water, the point being, you don't need to carry as much as you think. And again, when it comes to food, is how much do you need to get you between one aid station and the next? So if you're arriving at an aid station and you've still got a whole bunch of food in your pack, assuming that's not the emergency rations that you might need to carry, then you've been carrying too much food.
Yeah.
Or you haven't eaten enough. That's the other question, is have you eaten what you should have done?
Yeah, well, on the Arc, there's only the one checkpoint that you can rely on at St. Ives, and that's 28 miles into the race. So I just didn't know how much the Arc Angels would have. But, if everybody went out with no food and used the Arc Angels, then there wouldn't be any food. So you've kind of got to sort of take enough for yourself and just have the odd Jaffa cake from an Arc Angel, which was what I did. But I think I could have taken a bit less food. That would have, and if I had a crew, then I could have taken much less food confidently. And I would, I know now about the water situation, so I would, maybe even save carrying a kilogram of all that food that I was carrying around and all that water. So I could definitely do with a crew. I could possibly get round if I had a crew. And now that I've been to the dunes, then I could get through them. So I think that's 5 covered. But there is also one, personally for me, don't make a film. I know the reason I was there was because I make films of these things. But for something with such tight cutoffs, I can't make a film as well. Because not only do you have to, focus on making the film, which is quite, it's an effort and it does slow you down. it's also about 600 grams of stuff to carry with the spare batteries and everything. So I don't, yeah, just carrying all that stuff. So next time, one of my patrons, Sean O'Keefe, he says he'll crew me and he'll film me. So
there you go.
Yeah, so there we go. I'll do that next time.
Yeah. And then you can still get the film out, but without you having to do so much of the work.
Yeah, exactly. It will be weird, but yeah, yeah. Yeah, was there anything else that we need to cover in the DNFs? I feel like we have 5 points now, but always room for another one.
Yeah, I think it's reflecting back on, you know, what happened. So it might be worth actually kind of writing this down, you know, write down what happened in the race and why did you end up with that DNF? And then sort of think about, well, how did that make you feel? You know, how do you feel about the DNF? And really try and spend that time, you know, evaluating what happened, why it happened, and then, you know, coming up with a plan from that. So, you know, once you then analyse that, you can then come up with an action plan. How are you then going to make sure that you deal with each of those points that happened in the race that led to that DNF? And then once you've got that action plan, then that then turns into what your training needs to look like for the next race, so that you address all of those different points. So it's just making sure that you learn, you know, if you do have a DNF, this is anybody and everybody, if you do have a DNF, it's why did it happen? And, you know, it's thinking about controlling the controllables. Sometimes a DNF will happen and it's completely outside of your control. Fine. You know, is it, you know, the weather suddenly comes in and the race gets cancelled? You know, that's a different situation. You can't control that. You know, do you have you have a really bad fall and sprain your ankle or something. You know, that's kind of borderline controllable. You know, should it have been that you should have been doing all your balance and strength exercises and training, or is it just a freak accident that happened? And if it's a freak accident that's outside of your control, you know, it's outside of your control. But if it's something that you could have controlled or you should have controlled, then is making sure you learn from that.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Well, I have written down 8 things here, so
okay.
I need to go and look at them. Jade has just said, because she did the race as well. She's one of my patrons. She said, having watched your film, you definitely could have made it. Don't beat yourself up. The start, the checkpoint and the mapping through the dunes were where you lost valuable time. So not even making the film then. And she says, not your fitness or the cake. Oh, bless her. That's so nice.
So cake is fuel. Cake is good.
Yeah. No, don't say that because I'll just eat more of it. No, having one bit a day.
It's why we do ultra runs and not kind of 100 meter track races or 1500 meter track races.
Yeah.
I always take the mickey out of my colleagues and athletes who are more track runners. It's like, well, you got it wrong. You don't stop for tea and cake in the middle of your races.
No, exactly. And your races don't take all day.
Yeah.
If that's okay with the DNF side of things, we've just got 2 patron questions from Sharon and Severine. And I know Sharon's one's going to be quite short, but I think she is listening live. So this will be really helpful for her to hear from a professional like yourself, Tim. So she's looking for some advice. She's been to the GP and waiting for stress test results. Blood's looking normal, but she's having some problems with her HR spiking. So running comfortably with like a HR of 167, which does sound quite high for like a comfortable run, and then all of a sudden it will go above 200. It's done this for about a year now, intermittent, usually when she's a couple of hours in. She used to be able to walk and then start again, it would be fine, but now walking isn't even bringing it down. So like the first thing I thought was, oh, is the watch right? But she says she seems to think that she can also feel it within her. So yeah, we just wanted a professional's opinion on this from
you. Yeah, I mean, if there's anything like that, you need to see a sports cardiologist. And yeah, it's looking at getting a stress test done. It's probably about wearing a 24 or 48 hour tape. So actually measuring your heart rate continually and just looking for anything there. It may well be that you need ECG or even an MRI scan, looking for anything else that's potentially going on there. So, you know, when it comes to the heart, you've got to take it seriously. I mean, you're right that, you know, sometimes we can get these errors that come on with, you know, poor connection with, you know, your heart rate strap, or your, you know, if you're using just wrist-based heart rate sensor, just the optical sensor on your watch, then the quality of that data is pretty poor. So sometimes you can get dodgy readings there. But if it's something like that where, you know, your trace is pretty steady, and then you can feel something's going wrong, you can see, you know, things are shooting sky high, you've got to work out why. And you can't mess around with that one. So, yeah, see the cardiologist and get that seen too.
Yeah, get a proper test there, Sharon. Yeah. Well, I hope that's helpful for you to know, Sharon. And yeah, good luck with that one, because it does sound scary if it's not the watch going wrong. I would definitely investigate that if you're not feeling too bad on these runs, because 200 is very high. And Severine has a question. She says she's still getting these leg cramps and finding it hard to run, like mainly long runs. She says she's sleeping well, eating well, taking electrolytes, warming up. She's having some blood tests done for vitamin and minerals. They've come back all good. A friend is saying it could be a lack of testosterone, but she thinks it might be an ongoing low level of stress and bereavements that are having a physical impact. She says she's also heavier than last time she trained for a marathon, and she's getting really demoralised. So, yeah, leg cramps and finding it hard to run. That's really tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's lots of different reasons why we'll get exercise-induced cramping. So historically, we used to think about it being a sort of hydration and electrolyte problem, which possibly can be. More realistically, it's going to be neurological fatigue. So again, it's just looking back at the training. So is the training actually meeting the needs in terms of are you trying to run too hard, too fast, too long, too many twos? And essentially then running out of gas, and that's where the cramping starts coming in. So just reflecting back on the previous training, seeing whether there's anything there. You know, again, it can be, you know, referral. So it could be that, you know, she's getting cramping in her legs because of some nerve irritation, and that could be higher up. So again, it might be worth booking in with a physio and just seeing if there's any other reasons why that the nervous system there is triggering these cramps. But yeah, again, there could be you know, physical manifestations from, you know, she has got high levels of stress as well. So that might be something else that needs investigating. So it could be worth, you know, having a conversation with a sports psychologist and coming up with some strategies there. So yeah, that might be something to explore as well.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that Severine could really do with a coach. Like, I think this would be a real benefit to you, Severine, there.
She, you know, she does want to have a conversation with, you know, sports psychologist. I've got Amy, who works with our athletes. She's our sports psychologist. You know, can do a one-to-one consultation there and, you know, explore that. Depends on what she needs to work on.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's time to widen the search and talk to some pros. She's actually on the treadmill, overheating. Excellent. At the moment, and watching us on the treadmill. That's really great to hear, Severine. So take Tim's advice there, book in with a sports psychologist, and get a coach as well, because I feel like a coach can give you this personalised information and really direct your training to the right places, because she's got two marathons coming up. You know, she's got like that 2-week gap between the marathons. Yeah. So that must be a bit stressful as well. Good luck with that, Severine, and keep us posted. Right. I think we need to end now, don't we, Tim? Because you need to go and look after some children of some sort for half.
Well, actually, they've gone out now. So that.
Oh, they've gone out. Oh, okay, right.
I do need to do some proper work today.
Yes, so you need to do some proper work as well, not just promote to your HPV coach.
Not just chatting.
Not just chit chatting. We'll just come to your everything that we can get from you in a mo. I'm just going to say thanks to NAC Sports Nutrition for sponsoring the live broadcast and podcast. I'm definitely looking forward to eating more of the delicious bars and waffles, and especially I'm going to test out the new energy drink powder on the Coventry Way 40, which is my next event in April. If you want to try some, use the code WildGingerRunning for 15% off at uk.nac.com. You're welcome. So Tim, you've got some training plans for us, haven't you? I've put a link to them in the film description below. Did you mention you've got something new coming, like poles stuff
A series of videos I'll be working on, so awesome. I'll be sort of posting those up again, just trying to improve people's skills for using poles, because a lot of people targeting, you know, longer races in the summer, and I've got a number of my athletes who have just bought poles for the first time, so just trying to improve their skills there. So yeah, I'll be posting those up. Probably sort of follow on Instagram for any heads up, and then any longer videos I'll try and put onto YouTube.
Yeah,
I haven't done much of my YouTube for a very long time, but
that's okay. You're doing this YouTube. That's fine.
Just put it online.
And I feel like people want some general training for really hilly races. You know, like have you got some like hilly race training plans on there?
Have I got them on your page? I'm not sure if I've got them on your page, but I can certainly copy some more kind of mountainous races. We can do that. We can sort that for you.
Yeah, awesome. And if you want any like coaching tips from Tim, and you want to buy any training plans from him to put in the Wild Ginger area, then just write a comment in the film description or the podcast. I don't think you can on podcast. Write a comment in the YouTube show comments below, and then I'll message Tim and get him to add them in, because you've got loads of training plans on there, haven't you, Tim? They're really, really useful. And if you feel like you can't kind of invest in a coach every month for like, you know, that kind of level of support, then buying a training plan from HP3 Coaching is like the next best thing. So how can we follow you, Tim, and find out more about what you're doing in Chianti?
Yeah, so social media wise, the main one I stick for the running is the Instagram, so Tim Piggott HP3, there's the website as well, which is hp-3.co.uk.
Awesome. Well, good luck in the rest of your training. I think we'll try to catch up with you maybe when you're tapering before Chianti. Would that be a nice time to catch up with you?
Yeah, probably would be, wouldn't it? Sort of, what's that going to be? Early March-ish?
Yeah.
We're now mid-March. Yeah, it'll probably be just before I fly out to Italy, something like that.
Yes, awesome. And you can tell us all about how I need to train for 100K.
Indeed.
In the summer.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tim. It's always bodaciously good to chat to you. Thanks, everyone, for watching. Bye, guys.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.